It's Muppeturgy, and a mysterious curse has compelled Daniel Lavery to join us to discuss the Jonathan Winters episode of The Muppet Show.
Yay!
Hey everyone, Hi. Welcome back. We're so glad you're here. I'm David Levy. Here today with me are
Adam Grossworth,
Michal Richardson,
Christy Bauer,
and our aforementioned very special guest star, Danny Lavery. Welcome to the show.
Hey, I'm so glad to be here and so deeply sorry for all that I've put you through.
You didn't make this episode.
Yeah, we're going to watch it either way. So we're glad that you're here to share the misery.
I am too. It was when you had asked me what episode I wanted to watch, I thought, oh, wow, Jonathan Winters. I didn't know that he had hosted an episode of The Muppets. I loved Jonathan Winters growing up. This will be a great episode. So that was all of my thought process behind recommending it. And then the minute I put it on, I thought, oh boy, I hope they don't keep going back to this well. And then they did the entire episode.
Yeah, we'll share some content warnings a little bit later before we get into the specifics of that. For those who are not familiar, Daniel Lavery is the author of Something That May Shock and Discredit You, and Text from Jane Eyre. Danny, this is a notoriously terrible episode of The Muppet Show. As we said, you've already talked about why you asked for this one. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what's your general relationship to The Muppets?
I would describe myself as like Muppet competent. I like more than just sort of passingly familiar, but not yet, I think, in the place that you all are at. But with a real affection that comes from having, you know, grown up watching reruns of The Muppets all the time. And I think like a lot of people of my generation sort of being introduced to a lot of variety shows of the 60s and 70s via The Muppets, like, spoofing or sending up of them. And so I feel like that sort of was like a backdoor entrance for me into a lot of like character actors who would later become an important part of my life. And I think often like also for people who grew up watching like early Simpsons, you often like get the reference there first and then work your way backwards until you eventually find out who Roy Cohn is.
That's a season 5 Muppet Show. We're not there yet.
Although we do have the octopus, which might as well be.
We actually, too, I was just thinking of people often do that prompt of like, what would be another great Muppet movie with a single human actor? And unfortunately, I think Roy Cohn with an entire squad of Muppets around him would have been really, really compelling to watch.
Well, maybe someday we will get Muppets in America. But first, we have the task at hand. Adam, take it away.
Here is a Muppet News Flash.
So we're here this week to talk about season 4, episode 16 of The Muppet Show. It was produced the week of January 15th, 1980, and it aired March 17th, 1980 in New York. It was number 19 in the air order between Anne Marie and Alan Arkin, who would both be great in Muppets, Angels in America. In the news, Gerald Ford has decided not to run for president, paving the way for Ronald Reagan. Yay.
What could possibly go wrong?
And Ted Kennedy is running against incumbent Jimmy Carter. That's just an interesting thing from this moment in history where we have the person who was president a term ago running again, which Ford decided not to do. And also, no one is running against Biden, but it keeps getting talked about. So this is what happened.
Excuse me, in 1980. Today, Marianne Elliott unsuspended her campaign.
Oh, God.
To try again.
Marianne Williamson.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Do you want to
all the Angels in America.
Leave all of it in.
As Mary much as
Elliott,
I would love
for those
to see.
Who don't know, directed the Broadway revival of Angels in America.
But
it's not Marianne Williamson, who believes that AIDS was our punishment for not praying hard enough or something.
But she's not running as a Democrat, isn't she?
Yes,
running
she
as an
is.
Independent? Oh,
no, no,
wow.
She's
okay.
In the primary.
Yes.
Well, moving right along.
She has fewer delegates than Uncommitted, which currently has 2.
Great. Moving right along to other politicians we don't like. Mrs. Thatcher tells Britons harder times are on the way. That's a direct quote of the New York Times headline to calling her Mrs. Thatcher, not Margaret Thatcher or Prime Minister Thatcher. And the U.S. Treasury Secretary has announced that there won't be any tax cuts this year, stressing austerity. So
I saw this headline and I thought this sounds like Danny Lavery wrote this headline. Mrs. Thatcher tells Britons harder times are on the way. And I just want to see the article that follows of what hardships we're expecting. And we're going to have to share our kippers among multiple families. And I want this to exist.
I mean, I'll see what I can do. Yeah, I can absolutely see that having happened. And kippers are actually really delicious. I feel like a lot of people don't know that, but they're actually really good.
Them.
No, you wouldn't. And they're hard to get here. Like they're there's only a handful of places that still make them. And I should have mentioned I had dinner early tonight, so I'm hungry again. And so that might be coming up again a lot as we talk.
Excellent. So we're thinking about kippers.
Elsewhere in the news, a powerful bomb exploded outside a Yugoslav bank office on the 30th floor of 500 Fifth Avenue in New York City, shattering windows whose glass shards showered down to the sidewalk amid crowds of St. Patrick's Day parade goers and others on 42nd Street. A fire department official reported, "No injuries, it's St. Patrick's Day." Not clear if that means there were no injuries or he was declaring it so.
Yeah, you can't hear our quizzical looks.
Yeah.
Or people were so drunk that they didn't feel them and thus didn't report them.
Oh, boy.
Just mostly I'm surprised I've never heard anything about this before. I mean, I guess it was fairly minor, but, you know, a bomb going off at a New York St. Patrick's Day parade feels like a story that might last a few years, but I guess not.
It does feel like sort of like how I associate the 70s with like an era of plane hijackings that everyone took really casually.
Yes.
It does feel like that was a bygone era of like you could still have a casual bomb that like did not actually kill anyone. And therefore everyone's just like, what are you going to do?
Bombs go off all the time. It's just the world's in a perfect place. Speaking of the world being in a perfect place, a maze of tunnels remains a refuge for the homeless. This is an article about a network of heating tunnels under and around Grand Central Station. Entrances to them include the Waldorf Astoria. I hope no one changed the number on them while they were out, resulting in chaos. There's a profile of Larry Hagman, who at this time was playing J.R. Ewing on Dallas. The headline on the food column, "More on Eggplants." I didn't read it. I was just delighted by the headline.
I like putting things on eggplants. I would easily put more on eggplants.
Yeah.
And just, again, the idea that like it's maybe kind of a new vegetable and it's just like we're bringing the news to you, the people.
What's going on there? This comes up a lot with the food column especially, but also with, you know, things like cable television and answering machines. Like, it's not that long ago. This is all within my lifetime. But yeah, there was a lot going on.
A few episodes back, it was like the new exciting thing, jicama, right?
Yes. I couldn't remember what it was. That's what it was.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really good ads this week. I'm only going to read a couple of them, but check out the show page for many screenshots, including a lot of fashion. But there's a two-page spread for Eastern Airlines, an airline that no longer exists. First class service at Coach Fare, coach service for less than Super Savers, and round trip from New York to LA or San Francisco was $298, which today would be $1,147, which is incredibly expensive. So that was interesting that was their cheap fare. There's an ad for Northrop, which is now Northrop Grumman. I don't understand why. They're like,
you should need to buy some bombs.
It's literally like, yeah, buy this stealth bomber. It's like an image ad. I get it. But I just was very jarring. There's an amazing ad that unfortunately is a bad scan. What I can read on it says, "Nothing to sneeze at, your cold remedy and 64 million bowlers." And it's by the National Bowling Council. And I think I figured out that it is an ad for ads. It's like you can advertise with the National Bowling Council, but all the small print you can't read in the scan of the paper. And I if anybody knows what this was, please tell us.
Did they have their own magazine or something?
I bet it's to get placed in bowling alleys.
In bowling alleys.
Yeah, it could be that. Yeah.
Of course, when you first said it, I imagine 64 million bowler hats.
Can't be wrong.
When you see it, there's a
people sneezing into bowler hats.
There is an image of a bowling ball. So with the visual, it's clear. But you're right that
when you were talking about more on eggplants, I was just thinking as like in comparison to brilliant broccoli,
to smart eggplants. Yeah. Oh, goodness. More about eggplants. Yeah. The bowling ball looks very alarmed in the ad.
It has a face.
No. Well, bowling balls all have faces because
like the man on the moon. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they did not give the bowling ball a cold, which would have been a much better art choice. Anyway, in movies, American Gigolo and Coal Miner's Daughter, we talked about before, Foxes with Jodie Foster, Scott Baio, Sally Kellerman, and Randy Quaid.
That is a cast party I do not want to go to.
I've started to pay more attention to the movies that we have not heard of, that have not lasted. So something called The Black Marble with Robert Foxworth, Paula Prentiss, and Harry Dean Stanton. The Fifth Floor, The Nightmare is Knowing You're Sane. And what's weird about this is from 1978. So they put this back in theaters for some reason. Also, it's on Freevee. And yes, I watched it. A college disco dancer is wrongly committed to an insane asylum. Robert Englund is in it as one of the patients before Freddy Krueger. It's actually really upsetting. I don't recommend it. But I also cannot imagine why they put it back into theaters.
I have a question about college disco dancer. Is it a college student who also goes disco dancing? Is it somebody who's majoring in disco?
I was actually confused by this. she is putting herself through college by working in a disco, which looks like no pop culture disco I've ever seen. Like it's like a dive bar that has a dance floor, like a lot of wood.
Is she like a go-go dancer?
She is. Well, it's more like a sweet charity situation. There's like a couple of girls who are like paid to dance. It's not like, you know, there's no Hey Big Spender happening. They're just like, they're just, their job is to be on the dance floor and I guess be good at dancing. And also like, if there's a man who looks lonely, to dance with him. But like, they never explain any of this.
It's a party motivator.
Sort of. They don't explain any of this. They just show it and it's sort of established that she's a student and this is her job. Yeah, it's actually a very weird plot point, which only really matters because of sort of how she gets committed. It's really upsetting. It's obviously meant to be this like hard-hitting thing about the mental health industry, but it's actually not a good movie. So it's like all the upsetting with none of the quality.
It's delightful.
Bad. Robert Englund, though, always delightful. Anyway, one last movie, A Small Circle of Friends. Harvard in the 60s, a time of social upheaval and student unrest. Three students bond together, challenge the system, and begin to lose their ideals. Starring Brad Davis as a character named Leonardo da Vinci Rizzo, Karen Allen and Shelley Long. And I didn't watch it, but maybe I should have watched this one instead. In theater, the box office opens today for Barnum on Broadway. And there's a play called Horowitz and Mrs. Washington by Henry Denker and directed by Joshua Logan, starring Sam Levine and Esther Roll. And that just seemed like a very 1980 thing.
That's funny. To me, that sounds like a 1960 thing. Like, Josh Logan is still directing in 1980.
Right.
Sam Levine is still acting in 1980.
Well,
listeners are like, I don't know who these people are. Why are you talking? Just get the Muppets.
Based on the ad, it's very much like, look at this old man and this black lady. Like, that's what the play apparently is about. And, you know, she would have been on Good Times at this moment, I think, maybe a little bit later. So on the Cashbox Pop Charts, the number one song is Longer by Dan Fogelberg. And the number one album is The Wall by Pink Floyd.
I tried listening to Longer, but it did not hold me for very long. I couldn't do it.
I grew up with that song on heavy rotation. Like, yeah. The second I saw that, I just like was immediately taken back to being like 7 years old and listening to Dan Fogelberg for some reason.
It was a lot. And the whatever music video version of it I was watching was using the papyrus font. And I was like, nope.
Oh, sure. Sure. I think it matches the falsetto that he's doing in most of the song.
It seemed appropriate, but yeah, not for me.
It's the sort of thing that you expect to hear when you're shopping at a Michael's.
On TV tonight, CBS, the usual, WKRP, The Last Resort, MASH, House Calls, and Lou Grant. ABC, That's Incredible, Family, and Stone. NBC had a rerun of Little House on the Prairie, followed by Armor and Company presents Bob Hope in The Star Makers. So right off the bat, what? Armor & Company was one of the top five meatpacking companies at the time, and they also made Dial Soap. Bob Hope and Robert Urich star in this variety special with a storyline, two agents auditioning youthful talent. What could go wrong? From the ad, we all know what a 10 is. Hope's a Hollywood agent on the show looking for an 11. The search is on to find the most beautiful girl in the country to fill that role. And they list the stars as Robert Urich of Vegas, special guest stars Bernadette Peters, co-star of The Jerk, Robert Guillaume of Benson. I always forget how early Benson was. Special attraction, Linda Gray of Dallas as Wendy Trousdale. Don't know why she gets a character name. With interruptions by Gallagher.
Nope.
Special appearance by Bear of BJ and the Bear, who, if you don't know, was a chimp. Plus six gorgeous starlets vying for attention.
None of whom have names.
Nope. But they're vying. That was followed by Tom Snyder's Celebrity Spotlight. The talk show host interviews Lonnie Anderson, Chevy Chase, Jack Lemmon, and Cher.
Now that is a cast party I would love to go to.
Yes. Oh, no, Chevy Chase. No, you wouldn't. Channel 9 had Seiji Ozawa conducting the Peking Philharmonic and the American Film Theater's version of Brian Friel's drama Philadelphia, Here I Come. And we talked about this last week or the week before, but I guess Channel 9 was classy at this point in time. This is not the Channel 9 that I knew. Just a couple years later.
Classier than Bob Hope looking for an 11?
Well, the bar is low.
And boy, do you have a treat in store. Because our guest star tonight is one of your all-time terrific, never-to-miss comedians, the king of nuttiness, Mr. Jonathan Winters. What good news?
Jonathan Winters, comedian, actor, Smurf. Jonathan Harshman Winters III was born in 1925 into a family whose fortunes were tied up in a bank that bore their name, the Winters National Bank, which was led by his grandfather at the time of Jonathan's birth. When the Depression hit just a few years later, their family fortune was lost. Jonathan's father struggled with alcoholism and had trouble holding down a job, By the time Jonathan was 7, his parents split up. The divorce weighed heavily on Jonathan, who described an unhappy childhood made worse by bullies who persecuted him for not having a father. He quit high school to join the army, and after 2.5 years serving in World War II, he enrolled in college. By 23, he was married to Eileen Schauder. And I just want to note that unlike Jonathan's parents, he and Eileen stayed together for more than 60 years until her death from cancer in 2009. Less than a year after they married, Eileen encouraged Jonathan to perform in a local talent contest, and he attracted the attention of a local radio station, which hired him as a DJ. Although he was just supposed to announce records, Jonathan honed his shtick on the air, eventually playing local club dates as well. In the mid-50s, he went to New York to see if he could make it, and he did. In addition to success in nightclubs, he worked his way onto television and made television history in 1956 when he broadcast the first public demonstration of color videotape on his eponymous television show. His growing success came with growing mental health concerns, and he ended the 1950s with an 8-month stay in a psychiatric institution. He spoke publicly about his struggles before that was common, both earnestly and within his comedy routines. Despite the setback, by 1960, he was a bona fide star, appearing frequently on The Tonight Show and in television commercials, and he began releasing popular comedy records on the Verve label, which I find interesting because Verve is primarily a jazz label, but they did very well. Around this time, he also ventured into acting, appearing on The Twilight Zone in 1961, and really making a splash in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World in 1963, for which he was nominated for a Golden Globe. He appeared in many film and television shows, so I'm just going to name a few that made an impression on me. In the final season of Mork and Mindy, he joined the cast as Mirth, Mork and Mindy's child, who, due to his alien physiology, aged backwards. In the 1980s, he was the voice of Grandpa Smurf on The Smurfs, and in the CGI era, he took on the role of Papa Smurf for the first two films in that series in 2011 and 2013. And of course, he was in The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh. In the 90s, he won an Emmy Award for his role in a sitcom I have absolutely no memory of called Davis Rules, but it did run for 2 seasons. And he also won a Grammy for Best Comedy Album. In 1999, he was awarded the Kennedy Center's Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. He died in 2013 at the age of 87, just over a week after completing his work in The Smurfs 2. That film was dedicated to him. So who has memories or impressions of Jonathan Winters they want to share?
I would be happy to get us started, especially since I kicked us all off. So I grew up, I just felt like he was on TV all the time. I think I remember him most from It's a Mad, 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 Mad World and The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, because those are the first things that I saw him in. But he was also the aging backwards guy on Mork and Mindy. And he was in a bunch of those like Hanna-Barbera specials and like weird offshoots of the new Scooby-Doo shows. He was a little bit like Dom DeLuise to me, where he was like a guy I grew up thinking like, sure, everyone knows this fat, funny gay guy. And then I lost my mind when I found out that Jonathan Winters was married to a woman for 60 years. Like, I think it was 2 years ago that I found out Dom DeLuise was married and had 3 sons with his wife. And I wanted to throw up. It was not that I'm perfectly happy for them. I'm not saying they needed to be gay for my own like mental adjustment. Just, it would be like if you had told me like, oh, the whole time, like, gravity is caused by magnets and we just forgot to tell you, or like, there's no such thing as Italy. Like, it was so destabilizing to be like, famous heterosexual Jonathan Winters. So I'm clearly still not over that, because it was just like, oh, this warm, like, introduction to like popular homosexuality that I thought I'd experienced. I was just like, no, he's a man with a wife. But of course, he was also with Rick Moranis in Gravedale High from 1990, playing Coach Cadaver, which was a terrific show.
I just looked up the cast of Davis Rules, and I won't read them all, but that was an amazing cast on that show. I also don't remember it in the slightest, but, you know, just a absurd list. Anyway,
he had that great kind of like post-war Steve Allen like career where you just go look at their credits and it's just non-stop stuff. Like, everything got the green light. Like, he's in Little Dracula, The Wish That Changed Christmas. You could put out an album for any reason, just constant book and TV and record deals in a way that is just like a little bit like watching old episodes of TV where people will just throw their litter out the window of the car as they're driving. Like, who cares? There's always going to be something to handle that. Just like, make another show. Why not? I'm done.
Okay. You don't have to be. I mean, it's It's interesting to actually hear you say all that, because like, I feel like I should know him from more than just Mork and Mindy, but for me, it's Mork and Mindy, a show that I think I liked, but I didn't watch like regularly as a kid. And I remember distinctly, like when he was there, I was unhappy. I think mostly because I think those later episodes were bad, like not because of him necessarily, but it's like, oh, it's one of the episodes with the giant baby. Also, like that character was creepy and weird by design. I mean, like they were doing a thing and I sort of respect them for it, but I didn't enjoy it. But like in that sort of monoculture way, we've talked about like it's, he was famous and around. And as a small child, I knew him from Rick and Mindy and therefore I knew who he was. And a very weird thing happened to me when I started watching this episode, which is that I remembered all of it. Not like it started and I instantly remembered the entire half hour, but like every single scene, I was like, oh yeah, this. Oh, right. This plot line. Oh, the octopus. Like all of it. And I certainly don't think I've watched it in 30 years or more. So that was just an interesting, of all the episodes that we have watched for this, why this one? I don't know, but it was in there somehow.
Yeah. As we have discussed, I think quite a bit, I had a very Nick at Night childhood. And I have this really distinct memory of right after they'd started showing Mork and Mindy, the first episode that came on that featured him, I was at my grandparents' house. And I remember my grandparents getting really excited because they were like, oh, it's Jonathan Winters and he's really funny. And I remember being like, this is creepy and weird. I don't understand it. But like they had a real like, oh, no, this is a funny guy. You're going to find him funny. And I remember being like, oh no. But yeah, my more recent point of reference for him is that he popped up a few times on the Carol Burnett show. And he did a lot of drag on the Carol Burnett show. In fact, a voice that he does in this, I was like, oh no, he's doing that mother what's her name character. So I think there's an element of you have to know his shtick to understand some of the references in this for it to be funny. And even like knowing that it was a reference, I was like, oh, no.
Do you want to know something I've just realized because of what you just said? I thought Jonathan Winters played the Glenn Shaddix character in Beetlejuice, which probably has to do like at least 50% of why I thought he was gay and why I had so much affection for him. They just look a little bit alike.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Glenn Shaddix is not Jonathan Winters. Also, there's no way he would have literally had to be aging backwards if he looked like Glenn Shaddix in Beetlejuice. But as a child, I was just like, they're all old things. They're all from the past. This explains a lot.
So we've sort of talked around this already, but Danny, what'd you think of the episode overall?
Boy, not great. It's not great. I think probably my favorite part was the little caterpillar singing "You'll Never Walk Alone" while all the leaves were sort of blown into his face. That was kind of charming. That was probably the biggest highlight.
David?
Well, on the one hand, it was racist. On the other hand, it was racist, but about other people. and in between that, there were things that I just found either not funny or baffling. There was a lot of music hall in this and none of it was the UK sketch. It just, there were so many choices that went into making this the antithesis of an episode that I would like. So this is a not for David one.
Michal.
So if you could cut Jonathan Winters out of this episode, it wouldn't be an altogether bad episode if you could also ignore the racism, which does get interrupted by more racism. Yeah. This episode does have its moments that are charming, and it didn't make me as actively angry as some of the other more offensive episodes that we've seen, though it was definitely an actively offensive episode. Also, there was something about the way this was put together where they were leaning so hard into the zaniness to the point where it seemed like after the perfect high-concept Liza Minnelli episode and the imperfect high-concept Phyllis George episode, somebody was like, hey, don't forget to be weird and zany and random like those lovable Muppets. And they leaned so hard that they made a nonsensical episode. This had its moments, but I wouldn't recommend it.
See?
I feel like I owe Phyllis George an apology. I hated this episode. The only thing I enjoyed in this entire episode of television was Bear on Patrol, which is the bleakest.
Ooh.
bleakest indictment of an episode. I don't know if it's at the bottom of the barrel for me. I mean, Spike Milligan is pretty terrible. Peter Ustinov was pretty terrible. But this is definitely in my bottom five for sure.
Well, it's Peter Ustinov all over again. I didn't hate it. I mean, I didn't love it. It's in the, you know, the bottom third for sure. But I thought it was fine, except for the racism. And I mean, actually, like, sort of the centerpiece, the Jonathan Winters like centerpiece thing was terrible, but like mostly in a dull way. And the racism, we'll get to it, but like, but it was like, I feel like I've seen worse. I don't know. Like I did not find it mostly pleasant. I found things to enjoy throughout. I will say that.
It was just benignly racist.
No, no. Speaking of, let's do this now. So just a content warning for this episode overall, that the episode uses a word for the Romani people that we don't use anymore. It was pretty impossible.
Except when we do.
Except when we do.
Except when we talk about the name of the musical.
Right.
That has that name. Yeah.
Right. And this is a fairly recent shift in the United States, at least. I feel like it's been happening for longer in Europe. And so I actually sort of looked it up. I looked it up. The word, while sometimes positively embraced by Romani persons, is also sometimes rejected by other Romani persons as offensive due to it being tainted by its use as a racial slur and a pejorative connotation, implying illegality and irregularity. And some modern dictionaries either recommend avoiding use of the word entirely or give it a negative or a warning label. So that's the context. And it was pretty impossible to avoid clipping it entirely. So you will hear it here. And, you know, there are differing views on it, but we're going to try to avoid saying it, I think.
And that's why on Disney Plus, you get the unskippable 12-second disclaimer.
They're back,
buddy.
They're back, and we checked, and they're back on the old ones too. We don't know what happened at Disney Plus, but so that conversation from a couple weeks ago is moo.
Stories still matter.
Jonathan Winters, 15 seconds to curtain, Mr. Winters.
Please, why do they do this to me? There's no time for that. Don't you know there's an old gypsy, and she's put a curse on the performance. I just can't appear tonight. I can't appear, I tell you.
Oh, but sir, there's no gypsy curse.
Oh, yeah. It's always people like you that say,
there's no gypsy curse.
Well, there is a gypsy curse. I saw her in the alley. Fright wig, a woman with hair clear out to here. One eye, that tells you something. One-eyed woman. She looked like she'd been hit from the back real hard. It just popped out. She said, there's a curse on the show. What does it take to believe me?
So, as he will do for the rest of the episode, Jonathan Winters teases us by promising us he won't go on, and then proceeds to go on anyway. And Scooter, who does not believe him, gets clonked on the head with a hat rack.
No, not a hat rack. The hat rack. It's credited our old friend, the hat rack.
It's the hat rack, credited on Muppet Wiki as the hat rack, who has a writer's credit in one of the season one episodes. So, good job, the hat rack.
It's Peter Ustinov, isn't it?
That sounds right.
Just to bring it back. That all felt very improvised, if only because of the character he's describing is not at all the character that we see, and no one seemed to tell him. But that's sort of the vibe we're going to get for much of the evening.
Yeah. A brief report from the Yay correspondent. Kermit gave us a very exuberant yay for this episode. I would say irrationally exuberant, considering what we're discussing. Anyway, Statler and Waldorf don't have a clip in the opening this week, but we did get the aforementioned old lady.
A voice upon this Muppet show!
There you go.
That's an accent.
I mean, she's standing in between Statler and Waldorf.
Yeah, she pops up in the box.
Yeah.
It's very cute.
Unlike the description of her eye, which is not popping out.
Right.
She has two normal eyes.
She is cursing the show, but she's not the way she was described.
I do love this puppet. It's a whatnot, but the way that they've styled her is pretty great.
Yeah, she's a cool looking puppet. It's too bad nobody seems to want her there. Also in the intro, Gonzo plays his trumpet and summons a horse.
You called?
So I learned this week that this fanfare is called First Call, and it's featured in Fugue for Tin Horns from Guys and Dolls, and therefore in the Pearl Bailey episode of Muppet Show. In case you were wondering where you had heard that little fanfare before, it was probably on the Pearl Bailey episode of the Muppet Show.
So as a native Kentuckian, I am honor and duty bound to inform you that First Call is a general name for this. in horse racing context, it's actually called Call to the Post.
Okay. I stand corrected.
It's called First Call when it's used in military context.
Oh.
Yeah. Which is a thing I learned this week, because when I was looking at the outline, I was like, wait, this is Call to the Post. What are you talking about? And then I went down a fun rabbit hole. So
it is one of those things that I like, I wonder if this is still true. Like, I have never been to a horse race in my life, but I knew what this was as a child. I still know what it is. Like, and not from Guys and Dolls. I mean, now I know it as the opening of Fuchre Tin Horns, but I don't know if it was Bugs Bunny cartoons, if there were just like more depictions of horse racing at the time, or I was exposed to more of them at the time, but this was just like, you just knew what that just meant. That meant horse was going to show up. That's,
I think, 9 times out of 10 when we have something like that, the answer is Bugs Bunny.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Or Groucho Marx and the Marx Brothers.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, or both, or one leading to the other.
I'm realizing how disproportionately exposed to horse racing I was as a child.
Again, purely due to
geography. Yeah, I'm just like, I just can't imagine not being around it. And I was like, you know what? That's kind of weird. Now that I think about it.
Although now that I think about it, it's weird that I haven't been to a horse race.
Well, and I mean, this is a bizarre rabbit hole, but we're here, so why not? The there were like ads for horse racing. Like there are ways to see horse racing in the New York City area, and like they would advertise on TV. And
yeah, I heard radio ads for racing all the time.
I'm from Massachusetts. We had dog racing, but I also never went to that, which also somehow seems way worse.
And Dan Fogelberg had that hit song "Run for the Roses" about horse races.
It's true.
Which I also grew up listening to.
my dad, for a brief period of time, co-owned a racehorse. My dad, my grandpa, and my great uncle. And or maybe, no, I think there were two of them. I asked my dad about this recently because I had a vague memory. I was like, did you guys own a racehorse for a hot second? And he's like, yeah. And the one I'm forgetting the name, but the other one, my great uncle did this without consulting my great aunt, whose name was Pat. And the horse's name was Don't Tell Pat.
That's pretty good.
That's a good name for a horse.
The Muppet Show backstage.
So backstage this week on The Muppet Show, as you might have heard, there is a curse on the show, and we open with a bang. Specifically, the bang comes from, well, two bangs, two sandbags falling directly behind Kermit, followed by a little animated lightning bolt, which I wouldn't have expected on The Muppet Show. It's very Sesame Street-esque, but it zaps Kermit in the head.
I'm going backstage to unfrazzle.
Yeah, poor Kermit.
I just really love the coinage of unfrazzle, and I had to clip it.
Yeah.
Which reminded me of the Sesame Street monster, Frazzle.
Right. If Kermit needs to unfrazzle, it would have been funny if there was just a monster cursing people on this episode.
Always trying to fix 40-year-old TV shows.
With Sesame Street. Listen, I give notes. It's my passion. The streak of bad luck continues backstage with a chair-taming accident.
Scooter, what's on next?
Oh, Patty Severn in her train chair. Oh,
okay. We're coming.
Huh?
Yep, we're ready. Ha! Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Could you use some very talented sticks?
Forget it. Let's see. On stage, Bernice and her half horse, half watermelon act.
Oh, bad luck, Kermit.
Hmm?
Yeah, the horse half just came down with hoof and mouth disease.
Could we just use the watermelon half?
What a bizarre and disgusting thought. Yeah.
That was my favorite line of this episode. It made no sense whatsoever, but it was charming. And yeah, the chair tamer falling over her chair. Puppets falling down is always going to work for me. Moving right along, Jonathan's props go missing, and he flails around, moans that he's ruined. It's a sight.
Kermit, I was so sad. Can we declare an intermission?
I tried that once. The audience left and they never came back.
Yeah, I feel that. Unfortunately, as we mentioned, Jonathan Winters goes on anyway and does his comedy.
I have been to a number of shows recently that did not have intermissions for exactly that reason. But I will not name names because I'm a professional.
Ooh. In spite of all this mayhem, none of it is enough to convince Kermit that anything is out of the ordinary.
Everything's pretty much as always.
Kermit, how can you say that? We are doomed. Yes, what has to happen before you realize that?
Honey,
What?
Something truly bizarre, hideous, and unnatural.
You called?
Gonzo, you don't count.
That is my one laugh of the episode, was Gonzo responding to that.
It's a good setup. So nothing convinces Kermit until a meteor crashes into the backstage and traps his flipper and pins him to his desk. And then aliens hatch out of meteor. We're really going for it. But they're not there to wage war.
They look like disco humidifiers.
They are beautiful, if somewhat perplexing, puppets.
They look great.
I love these aliens.
Yeah, they shoot steam out of their head.
Their little eyes.
They are entirely bedazzled.
Yeah, they're very...
Their eyes are like Floyd's eyes if they blink sideways. It's a really nice touch. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're really cute. I got no beefs with the aliens. I would have thought that they were, if we're cursed, that they were going to start shooting people, but they just kind of loom around, not even menacingly. They're just cute.
They got to get into the act.
Yeah. They're here to break into show business. So things are also getting weird in Jonathan's dressing room. First, a shark wanders in.
Oh, interesting, interesting.
Excuse me, I'm looking for Jacques Cousteau.
Would you open, please?
Oh,
yes, there he is.
I enjoyed that. That was much funnier than any of his stand-up.
So. Okay.
And then later in his dressing room, an alien wanders in, claiming that he is Jonathan Winters.
What planet are you from?
I'm from Earth.
Are you from Earth?
Yes. I'm a comedian.
Are you a comedian?
Yes.
Steve Martin, gosh, you'll anything, won't you?
I enjoyed the dig at Steve Martin. Both of these bits really felt improvised to me, even more than the opening rant. Like, it really seemed like he didn't actually know what was going to come through the door. And I mean, also neither of them felt written in the way the show usually feels written. And they're talking over each other and stuff. But, you know, I kind of appreciate that's his thing. And so they tried something, even though it didn't work very well.
I was charmed. I would have watched more of that. Anyway, this curse reaches its conclusion with a prediction so dire that two chickens faint dead away.
I just met that old gypsy woman in the alley.
Mm-hmm.
She made a dire prediction.
A dire prediction?
So what was the dire prediction?
Well, the old gypsy woman said that in the final stages of the curse,
mm-hmm.
everyone would turn Swedish.
I don't believe it.
Girls, did you hear that? In the final stages of the curse, we'll all be flirndus, blirndus,
scurrying.
Oh, it's happening already. Gonzo just turned Swedish. Soon everyone will furzy. Come here, it's here, come here.
It is really cute as they all turn Swedish one by one. And Kermit does, like, not his usual little squishy thing with his face, a different little squishy thing with his face. That is a lot of fun. He looks very distressed. And no one coherent is left to introduce the closing number.
And now, the closing number! Yeah! I always wanted to do that.
She's so cute. I'm rooting for her.
I love the way she cuts herself off on the yay to say, I always want to do that. And it's, I mean, it's, you can hear it in the clip, but like the puppetry is really great too. Like it's a full body weight. I've been going on too long. I don't know. I really liked it.
She has a good time.
Yeah. And it was, there's something just deeply charming hearing everybody start a line, knowing that it's going to turn into Swedish at some point by the end of it. And like catching the different moment when suddenly it turns into, you know, Hergeberga. It's beautiful. It gets me every time.
Yeah, that part of things is pretty delightful, and it affects almost everybody.
We interrupt this entertainment to bring you an important news bulletin. Not everyone on the show is turning Swedish. I, for one, have remained my normal self.
There is one type person unaffected by the curse.
I am that type.
The boring and stupid type person.
Actually, I am sort of starting to feel Swedish. Smorgasbord, Stockholm, Ingmar Bergman, Meatball.
By the way, if you want to have at least as much fun, I would say, watching an ensemble of Muppets speak in mock Swedish, do yourself a favor and look up The Muppets Go to the Movies, which is a TV special from 1981, which was made to promote The Great Muppet Caper, hosted by Lily Tomlin and Dudley Moore. And specifically, look up the sketch Silent Strawberries, a black and white tribute to Ingmar Bergman films, translated into English by Sam the Eagle.
What's the sukur das mo Svinborgor? Snurka nut bulls,
What do you get when you add sugar to hamburger? Sweetish meatballs. What is going on?
Ah, druska, druska, druska.
Waka, waka, waka.
Gisterborg, gestringerborg, gaboozik neighbor.
Who did this? Who did this? I want no part of this.
God, I'd rather be watching
that. I had never seen that before until you asked me to clip it. And Beaker is dressed as Death. And it is so cute.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's really, really great. I didn't spoil the whole sketch because there's so much wonderfulness in it that you should go watch it. I'm glad I got to share that with you. So maybe this helps offset the racism and maybe it doesn't. But we learned that the old Romani lady did not curse the show with malicious intent. It was just business.
And I demand it now. Wait a minute. I can talk. The spell is broken.
We're saved.
It's just that your time is up. You guys only paid me for the half-hour quiz.
Well, thank goodness.
But wait a second. You mean you two geezers paid for a gypsy curse to be put on our show?
Yeah, but I didn't think it would include us.
And for another hour, it's only $7.
I regret to inform you this just plays into a different racist trope.
I was worried about that, yeah.
Yeah, like I recently watched an episode of Alice where Leni Kazan curses the diner as a way of basically blackmailing them because they get mad at her for stealing the silverware. It's a whole thing.
Wow.
The 70s.
What a time.
Well, we've got a real mixed bag of music to talk about this week. We start in a fairly feline place.
Hold the tiger, 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 hold the tiger.
Mm-hmm.
So, I realize that I get angry when the majority of the songs in any episode of The Muppet Show are songs that I do not know or like. And I think that's why I'm angry at this episode more than reasonable. Anything else.
So this is a song called Tiger Rag. It was later called Hold That Tiger when lyrics were added to it. But it's credited to, strap in, Eddie Edwards, Nick LaRocca, Henry Ragus, Tony Sbarbaro, and Larry Shields. It's from 1917, and these guys were the original Dixieland Jazz Band, their name, not their distinction. And apparently only Nick LaRocca was actually responsible for the writing of the melody. The band was actually initially called the original Dixieland Jazz Band.
Sure.
Until they apparently realized that that's not how jazz is spelled.
Better than a jizz band.
It's, well.
We'll talk about that more next week.
Yeah, I was going to say, I enjoy Max Rebo and his ilk. Yeah, this is a very popular jazz standard. It's been recorded by everyone from Louis Armstrong to noted Joe Raposo, Stan Frank Sinatra.
Sinatra recorded Hold That Tiger?
Apparently.
Huh.
And it's just that line over and over again. Like, am I missing something?
I was so annoyed by this that I didn't look it up. I would hope so. I hope. But the words were added by Harry DaCosta. So
it's five dudes who wrote the music, and it needed an additional dude to write the lyrics.
Took two people to write that song?
Go.
Thank you.
There are a handful of other words.
Yeah.
According to whatever lyrics that I just Googled.
Yeah. And incredibly wild is, according to the research of Barry Kowal of hitsofalldecades.com, which is a very interesting website that I discovered doing research for this. I recommend it. It has a very old internet feel to it. It's very entertaining. It is the 32nd most recorded song in the era of 1890 to 1954.
So when I read this, I was like, what is the 32nd most recorded song of our era? And I could not find that specifically, but I did find a 2021 Newsweek article that said the 32nd most recorded song of, quote, all time is Over the Rainbow. And it is wild to think that in 1954, this song was as well known as Over the Rainbow is today.
I can't.
Hour of Jess.
Yeah. But this is the fight song, unsurprisingly, for several college teams, including LSU, Auburn, Clemson, and the University of Texas at Dallas. So go Tigers of varying stripes.
In the 80s, it was used as a commercial jingle for the clothing brand La Tigra, appropriately. But it was like weirdly ever present. Like it was one of those ad campaigns that ran for years and was always on.
So we should probably talk about what's happening here.
Oh, yeah. There's stuff on screen. There's a tiger. There's a lion.
Aren't any bears.
Oh, my.
But there are some pig lion tamers, and they unsuccessfully tame Butch the tiger and Sundance the lion. And
to clarify, they are pigs who are lion tamers, not pig,
right.
pig lion. Not tamers then, of pig lion.
So like,
not college disco dancers.
So it's like a whole circus thing with the tiger. But then the lion arrives in a cowboy hat with guns and rescues the tiger. And then they call each other Butch and Sundance, and it becomes that thing. And I just was so muddled and confusing. And the staging was muddled and confusing, too. It was just like a big clump of Muppets to really...
Yeah, it all happened very quickly. They didn't sing Hold That Tiger for much longer than the clip we heard. Then the lion shows up and it's over. They're cool puppets.
It was a little weird that on the circus set, there are these three rings, but they're vertical. So it's not like a three-ring circus ring.
They're the rings of fire that the tiger has to jump through.
Right. It seemed, but they weren't really set up in a orientation that in a real circus one could jump
because also like
them.
A so puppet has to get through them. So you can't see the bottom.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, it was bad.
Poor Butch and Sundance. After an escape like that, they'll have to hide out in some dismal, dark, depressing hole in the wall.
We'll hide out here, Butch.
Okay, so moving onward, we have some music hall nonsense, because of course we do.
There's a pair I often see as they stand beneath the moon. And the other night he just let himself go.
What did he do?
He kissed her.
Who did?
He did.
Where?
On her doorstep last night. He hugged her.
Who did?
He did.
Where?
On her doorstep last night. He said, you are my darling Kate.
Then he squeezed her fingers in the garden gate.
Then he kissed her.
Who did?
He did.
Where?
On her doorstep last night.
This is weirdly more charming out of context than it was in the show.
Yeah, I agree. So I called it music hall. It's a slight misnomer. It's from a slightly later era. It's from 1929. It was written by Henry B. Tilsley, Robert Hargreaves, and Stanley J. Dameril. It was first recorded by Percival Mackey and his band, recording secondhand songs. And it was also recorded by Jack Payne and the BBC Dance Orchestra in 1930. And if these writers sound vaguely familiar to Muppeturgy diehards, it's because they're also some of the writers of Lady of Spain, which Marvin Suggs and his Muppetphone did in the Rita Moreno episode.
If one mention of them 3 years ago has stuck with you, then like, come join us on the podcast. You deserve an award.
You never know. You never know. But also, along with Tolchard Evans, these guys wrote Let's All Sing Like the Birdies Sing. So shout out to my fellow Enchanted Tiki Room stands. So I have a suspicion as to why this would be in the zeitgeist for the Muppet Show gang to include. And it's because it was in the repertoire of the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band.
No.
The what?
Hear me out. They were a British novelty outfit from the 60s that played a lot of vaudeville music hall songs in like a retro 20s style. And their members included Neil Innes from Monty Python. And they actually appear in the movie Magical Mystery Tour. They're the originators of the song Death Cab for Cutie, which is the source of the name of the band, Death Cab for Cutie. And their recording of this from the 60s is a lot faster and the jokes land better. I mean, I won't say that they like fully land, but like you get more of that like innuendo, you know, miscommunication of it when it's rat-a-tat, which this decidedly is not.
I mean, to be sure, this is pretty cute.
Oh, it is. It's charming in its way, but it can actually be funnier.
Yeah, this worked for me just because it's Fozzie and Scooter, which is a pairing we don't see a lot. And I really enjoy these performances, even though this is a song I never need to hear again. And then the aliens show up and they do point their guns at them very threateningly. And I don't know. I found it all very cute.
Yeah, Fozzie is the MVP of this episode. He's throwing everything he's got to entertain us. And there's a lot of Fozzie this episode. There's no Miss Piggy. Frank Oz is just concentrating all of his efforts.
Well, he's also one of the aliens.
Yeah.
The one that sounds like Bert.
Right, the one that laughs like Bert. But yes, all right, most of his efforts into helping Fozzie to keep us watching.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason that we all experienced a real drag this episode, in addition to the sort of language, is just because the running gag is, I can't go on, we mustn't do the show, you often get the feeling that like nobody really has an idea for what the show should be about. So the handful of moments where it feels like, hey, there's like a well put together concept, they know what they're doing, this is on purpose, which I think is what the Muppets do best, is like the sincerity, we really tried, we're really going for this. It's more enjoyable than the other stuff that it really does feel like maybe they didn't have an idea for a show this week.
100%.
Yeah, it's a less confident flavor of chaos.
And it sort of feels like Jonathan Winters actually doesn't want to go on. Like he's not entirely sure why he's there, which doesn't ever help.
Weirdly enough, that was not the UK spot, in spite of the fact that the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band version was originally released on an album called By Jingo, It's British Rubbish.
What a phrase.
Instead we spend some quality ? Time with the old Romani woman.
By the burning fire they will call with every call.
You will hear desire this below inside your soul.
Oh, me, my gypsy, make love your guiding light, and let this tale of all your feelings cast a spell tonight.
Uh-huh. This is a song called Golden Earrings, which was the title song from a Marlene Dietrich movie from 1947. And Golden Earrings, the movie, is, per Wikipedia, a romantic spy film set at the very end of World War II, which is very timely. That always blows my mind. It's like, anytime I think about Casablanca being made when it was made, it's like, wow, okay. But this is definitely not Casablanca. So in this movie, Dietrich plays a Romani woman. And the song has music by Victor Young, who scored the movie, and lyrics by Ray Evans and Jay Livingston, who I'm surprised we haven't talked about more. These guys were very big movie lyricists, and among their credits include Buttons and Bows, Que Sera Sera, and I just learned, thanks to David, the Mr. Ed theme songs. And my favorite thing, this is going to sound morbid, but my favorite thing that I learned about them in doing research for this is that they're both buried in Westwood Cemetery. And I only say this is my favorite thing because I've been to the Westwood Cemetery a couple of times, and the first time I went, there were so many people from classic TV there, like Eddie Albert's there, and Ava Gabor's there, and Robert Crane is there, Richard Dawson, that I mean, I was by myself, but I said aloud involuntarily, all my friends are here. So yeah, that's pretty self-incriminating. But yeah, but I didn't realize that they were there. So the next time I go, I will have to visit them as well.
Additional friends. It's nice to make new friends.
Yeah, right? Anyway, this is a real splash of stereotype all over the screen.
It's sort of a beautifully shot number. So like, I don't care for the song, I don't care for the setup, but like, it's like an interesting group of Muppets in a beautiful setting, sort of like an evening campfire caravan sort of thing. It felt like a nice change of pace in an episode that has very little that happens outside of like the Muppet Theater areas.
The costumes are really beautiful. I have, you know, no idea if they're accurate or stereotypical and offensive, but they really look pretty, which I at least could appreciate that, the craft there. And Link seems to have acquired more chest hair.
That's nice for him.
I didn't understand all of it, but I'm certain the English people enjoyed it.
Let's walk on, if we must.
With hope in our hearts.
At the end of the storm is a golden sky and the sweet silver song of a lark. Walk on through the wind, walk on through the wind.
Hmm. Yeah.
Never realized how much that song benefits from woodblock use.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, if we must. This is You'll Never Walk Alone from Carousel, written by Rodgers and Hammerstein, from 1945. It is in modern day known sort of best outside of show tune circles as the anthem of the Liverpool Football Club. And that's due to the success of Jerry and the Pacemakers cover that was number one in the UK for 4 weeks in 1963. And it has sort of subsequently been adopted by other soccer teams and teams of other sports. And, you know, it was used to honor first responders and boost morale during the pandemic in the UK. It's especially meaningful to British people generally.
In 2017, there was a British documentary called You'll Never Walk Alone, all about like the cultural impact of this song in Great Britain.
Huh. Okay, I might need to see that to reframe it because I fucking hate this song. I have such a deep, like, I despise this song on a cellular level. And it's partially because I have this weird thing that happens in my brain where it's like I've forgotten how to process music. Like, I am not moved by anything about this song in the slightest. You know, I think on the show I've mentioned before that, like, Sondheim quote about, what was it? The Richard Rodgers, like, was, like, all talent and no... Or not talent. What's the...
We're going to have to Google this.
Craft and, I think it's craft and heart, right? Like...
Yeah,
it's Richard Rodgers
or soul. It's like one of them is soul and one of them. Anyway, doesn't matter. I am a person who loves Rodgers and Hammerstein quite deeply and am often quite moved by their songs, even in shows where they don't work. But did you find it?
Infinite talent, but limited soul.
Limited soul. Yeah. And Hammerstein
was the opposite.
Was. Infinite soul, limited talent. Yeah. There is such a plinky plunky paint by numbers quality to the melody of this song. It feels like the worst qualities of Rodgers and Hammerstein amplified to a million.
What's interesting is that although this sort of became a prototype for a song that they would write over and over and over again, this is the first of them. Like, you know, Climb Every Mountain comes many years later.
Yeah.
But they are sort of interchangeable.
Yeah, I mean,
except like, the Climb Every Mountain, I think, is maybe a better song. Maybe,
I mean,
I'm not
the
sure.
Song was is They're even in the key of C. Like, it just feels like a piano lesson exercise.
Yeah.
And it's wild to me that millions of people. I mean, and I write musicals. Like, it is moving to me in the abstract. No, not in the abstract. It is moving to me. Full stop. That this song is meaningful beyond its original context. I think that's great. I just don't understand it. And, you know, it's just like, I hear it and I'm like, I don't. Anyway, I'm rambling because...
Well, what I love about this song, like, slash hate about this song, is in the original context, it's written as a graduation song that has sort of a double meaning because of what's going on in the scene.
Right.
But it sort of has the stink about it in this, that like a song like The Black Eyed Peas, I Got a Feeling, has, where it's like, oh, they wrote this song because they wrote Mazel Tov into it, so we played it every bar mitzvah for the next generation. And like, you sort of think that Rodgers and Hammerstein had that in their head too when they wrote this as a graduation song. They're like, oh, now every school choir is going to sing our song. We're going to make so much fucking money from it.
They're the vitamin C's of their time, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was nice that it had all the little boots on. I think that was a nice moment.
We should say.
So many little boots.
Yeah, there's Caterpillar and
some really cute rain gear.
Yeah, he's literally walking
it's a really cute puppet. I feel like the Muppets maybe shouldn't do insects, because this is at least the second time that I've had a problem with scale. Because there's all these umbrellas blowing by in the wind, but they're the size of the caterpillar. Like they're
well, maybe they're from other insects.
It's true. He is wearing a raincoat and a hat and boots, so that is a possibility. But I found it odd.
Is it because he has so many pairs of legs that he'll never walk alone? Because he's always accompanied by more of himself.
Great question.
That's good.
I kept waiting for a joke, like a punchline. Like, then the joke is, like, look at this creature with lots of legs walking. That is the whole joke. But like, I kept waiting for a punchline and it never came.
He's persevering.
I feel like the joke was also, yeah, that like a leaf would occasionally blow into his face and it was getting harder for him to walk. And it was like, he's really, if you were a little caterpillar wearing boots, probably a leaf would really hold you back.
Yeah. Maybe if this was supposed to be escalating in a way that didn't quite come across, that like he's walking through a storm and now he's walking through leaves and now he's walking through leaves and umbrellas. But
I mean, the joke is sort of like this idea of walking through a storm with your head held high is supposed to be inspiring, but actually it's fucking miserable.
It's true. You should probably put your head down when you're walking through a storm, just for practical purposes.
Yeah.
Incidentally, that line about holding your head high, there's like a big disagreement in like scholarly musical theater circles, because there's two different versions of that line that circulate. There's keep your head held high and keep your chin up high. And there is not an authoritative answer as to what the right lyric is, because it appears differently in different recordings that Oscar Hammerstein himself was involved in, and differently in different published versions that he would have had eyes on. And like, I think it's just sloppiness on his part. But for a song that is so beloved and popular, it's fascinating to me that it's also so unstable.
Meanwhile, if you enjoyed me ranting about You'll Never Walk Alone, get ready to hear Michal rant about Morris dancing. So this is English Country Garden, which we've actually talked about before. It was played amazingly as a piano duet with Ralph and Fozzie in the J.P. Morgan episode in season 2. I definitely recommend going back and revisiting that rather than this, which is, it's some trolls dancing to it, including the one that looks like Harold Zilder from Moulin Rouge. And yeah, just as a tiny refresher, it's a traditional English folk song, and it can be traced back as far as 1728. And it is used quite frequently for Morris dancing, which Michal has many feelings about.
So I am an aficionado of a dance called contra dancing, which is an American folk dance and is a descendant of English and French folk dances. Morris dancing is an English folk dance where people clomp around and hop up and down awkwardly and wave hankies at each other and hit each other with sticks. And it's weird. And
aren't there bells also?
There are bells, and they wear them on their shins so that you can hear them coming and get out of the way. I am contractually obligated to be little Morris dancers.
This is where Danny tells us that he is actually a committed Morris dancer.
I am not, but I did earlier this year attend a traditional English sword dance at the New York Public Library.
Ooh.
Oh, a sword ale?
No, it was like a specific type of blunted swords that they all like arrange in a diamond pattern and then sort of walk around. It's actually remarkably bad. I feel bad because, you know, it's an event at the library. It's free. They're clearly just like amateur enthusiasts, but they were very, very bad. They danced very slowly and clumsily, and you could tell they were still learning it.
Oh.
And it wasn't good.
A lot of the same people who do the Morris dancing and the sword dancing.
And actually, clear, like, I couldn't do that. I'm a very bad dancer. If you asked me to like even do that much, I would probably look worse. So it's not like I want to be too hard on them. I just it there's a reason it didn't catch on internationally.
Okay, I'm here to be hard on the Morris dancers.
I was pleasantly surprised by these puppets. Their faces moved more than I would have expected, considering that they can't possibly have a hand inside them and they would not have been remote controlled at this point. I think it's just the movement of the dancing like makes the faces bounce in a way that looks like an expression. I don't know. I partly because on the Tough Pigs Discord, people were anticipating us doing this episode and talking about how much they hated the trolls. And I was like, I think they're kind of cute.
You had nothing good to say about the troll when we were talking about the last
Correct.
Episode.
That is true. In this context, it worked better. There are three of them. They all look different. Their designs are kind of neat. I mostly didn't like the way that the troll was used in the Copacabana number. So here where there's three of them and they're just doing this weird dancey thing, which goes on for far too long, I was sort of charmed by them.
Well, that's the thing, is this whole number just felt like filler, because like this is really what's happening while everyone is turning Swedish. But it gets more attention than something that is truly happening in the background, but less care from like the people putting together the Muppet Show than something that gets this much screen time probably should have got. So it was just sort of a weird, like, is this an act or is this background? Because it sort of fails at both.
Right.
I mean, they had to learn choreography. They were really on stage doing their thing. And it wasn't Morris dancing. They were doing more like ballet dancing.
Never mind that jazz. Listen, turkey.
What? And get out of show business?
All right, so we're going to have to talk about Jonathan Winters as a stand-up. So he keeps threatening to not go on, and he does. Fozzie rescues the whole situation by not only providing his personal box of props after Jonathan's props go missing, but Fozzie hides inside the box and keeps handing Jonathan some hats as Jonathan Winters does his bit. He's a man of a thousand voices.
Oh, this is going to be great.
Is it?
I think so.
I'll be the judge of that.
Yes, sir.
So, unfortunately, a bunch of those voices are racist, or at least the only ones that I can remember were the racist ones. Anyway, here is a John Wayne bit from right before a racist bit.
Well, I don't care what you say. I'm not afraid. Sure, there's 6,000 Shoshone. You walking bear, come here.
His John Wayne is better than Rich Little's.
Yeah.
I mean, Fozzie's John Wayne is better than Rich Little's.
True.
Also, am I the only person whose first thing they think of? I mean, this is similar to the like thing about Jerry Orbach's eyes on the subway. There was that ad in the 90s for like a colon cleanse that where they talked about how supposedly John Wayne died with like 20 pounds of stuff in his system.
No.
What?
Of what?
I mean, of,
is this real?
I'm just like,
sorry, I know you're euphemizing something, but I actually can't tell what the euphemism is.
I mean, feces, I assume.
Yeah, right? Like, yeah, yeah. Just like a really, really blocked colon. I
like, don't be like John
there
Wayne.
There were ads on the subway?
No, they were TV ads.
No, on TV, which is work.
It was on TV.
The ads on the subway were about how you should donate your eyes and be like Jerry Orbach.
Is this a Kentucky thing?
No, it was a national ad.
Are you sure?
You can't say that on TV. You can't go on TV and lie about how much waste was inside the corpse of John Wayne when he died. Can you?
I don't know,
okay, when you Google John Wayne's colon, the first result
is Snopes.
40 pounds.
He would have been distended. He would have looked pregnant.
I mean, but Snopes says
there would have been headlines.
Yeah.
Wait, Snopes says...
Of course it's false.
Yeah.
That he did not die with that much in his colon. Does this say anything about this TV ad?
Right, that's...
Why would they know this in the first place?
Well, John Wayne did have an operation for an intestinal blockage in 1979, according to the New York Times, so...
And like,
there is that.
Colonic irrigation was very trendy in the 80s. I don't know if you ever saw the film L.A. Story with Muppet Show guest star Steve Martin.
Yeah.
And there's a whole running joke in that about getting colonics for, I don't know, like recreational purposes.
Jeez. What a time.
Anyway, so Jonathan Winters' first two bits are a sea captain and a like British somebody. And especially when then the John Wayne thing happened, it felt like they were specific references, but I had absolutely no idea what they were, and neither does Muppet Wiki. And I just wondered if it would have been funnier if I knew what he was going for, because it wasn't, and I didn't.
I don't know. It's AC Captain.
Yeah.
I didn't need for it to be that specific. It was fine.
For what it's worth, this is sort of not the only thing that Jonathan Winters was famous for, but one of the things he was famous for, like he would go on The Tonight Show and do characters in his conversations with Johnny Carson. So I think that like this is what people would expect from his appearance on The Muppet Show. And maybe it played better than when people had kind of that frame of reference.
Right. Yeah. The context was lacking.
Yeah. Speaking of things that play better then, he puts on a native headdress and does a dance, and that's not great.
Yeah. And also speaks in, I assume, a fake language. And
I assume it's fake. Right. I don't.
But he does also point out, like, he makes a joke at the end about, like, that's the most lines an Indian's ever had in one of these movies. So, like, he's sort of, like, aware of the shitty treatment of Native people in popular culture, even as he is perpetuating it. So, I don't know, half a point for him.
Yeah, that does garner wild applause from the fake audience. And he says that's a lot of lines. Yeah.
Yeah. On a lighter note, what the fuck is he wearing?
You mean aside from the offensive headdress?
Yes. Like his regular outfit throughout the episode, it's baggy pants that are either black or navy with a red stripe down the side and suspenders over a turtleneck.
That makes the pants go faster.
And a blazer. I was very confused.
It was confusing.
I always picture him as sort of dressed like an amateur sea captain. So
the turtleneck with the blazer makes sense for early 1980. It was sort of the suspenders.
Well, maybe that's a tribute to Robin Williams.
Maybe. And the stripe down the pants, too.
It feels like something that, like, one of Jessica Fletcher's, like, gay older friends would have worn on a, like, mid-episode of Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
How about that? They brought the house down.
That's an old joke.
Well, some things improve with age.
You don't.
Let's talk about Christy's favorite part of this episode, the cop part. Patrol Bear, Fozzie Bear in a cop uniform, enters mid-wrestle with an octopus.
Listen, would you get back in uniform before I put you on report? That is not regulation headgear.
No, this is my prisoner, sir. I caught him picking pockets at the aquarium.
Did you catch him wet-handed?
Terrific.
So Fozzie attempts to take the octopus's prints, and the octopus takes Fozzie's prints instead and also takes his whole uniform, and Fozzie gets knocked out a bunch. Frank Oz, as mentioned, very good at his job. Fozzie really shines here.
It's the physical comedy that I appreciated, not the copness.
Not the old cops.
I'm with you, Christy. I'm finally listening to the Jim Henson biography by Brian J. Jones, and someone I didn't write down, but I think it was Jerry Jewell, is quoted saying Frank Oz is the best puppeteer in the world. And yeah, we make that joke all the time, but like, for real, it's really good. The octopus is on Fozzie's head. And as far as I can tell, there's a couple rods on a couple of the tentacles that somebody is manipulating, but like, it's all Frank inside Fozzie, making it look like that octopus is fully alive, almost all, plus the tentacles.
Yeah. And it's, but there are multiple people. Like, somebody is presumably right-handing Fozzie, and also somebody is manipulating the octopus. So, like, two people are hugging Frank while he is demonstrating Fozzie getting knocked out by himself.
But at first glance, it's like it seems like there is a hand inside the octopus's head, and there is not, which is also pretty remarkable.
And then at the end, the octopus leaves wearing Fozzie's uniform, and Fozzie realizes he's naked, all of which is really cute.
Link has acquired some new medals pinned to his chest and a patch on his sleeve that maybe was always there, but it was very legible this time. It says Macho Desk Sergeant, which I enjoyed.
Maybe he needed the chest hair in order to acquire those medals.
Maybe, yeah.
All right, one more sketch we're going to talk about here. This is the Muppet Labs Luggage Compressor.
Introducing the new Muppet Labs Luggage Compressor. My assistant Beaker will demonstrate. Okay, Beaker, I see you've dressed like a tourist to make the demonstration more realistic. Very cute.
So Beaker demonstrates the luggage compressor, which is a conveyor belt like you would put your luggage through at the airport. And it works perfectly. It compresses his little suitcase. It works so perfectly that Beaker ends up on the conveyor belt and gets compressed himself.
Come on, Beaker. Uncle Bunny will just put you in an envelope and mail you to the hospital.
This is the most flirtatious we have seen them yet.
Mm-hmm.
Uncle Bunny, I mean, I don't want to kink shame anybody, but
some people want to get compressed in a luggage compressor.
My guy, you can't give yourself a nickname. Like,
we for sure heard Uncle Bunny before, and
yeah,
it bothered me then as well.
I don't care for it.
Well, but this time he's carrying Beaker, a flattened Beaker.
I will say this is the first Muppet Labs invention that I sort of wish was real. I was like, how lovely would it be to just like take your luggage in little flat stacks to the airport?
Yeah, much more useful than edible paper clips or a banana sharpener or
yeah,
gorilla detector.
Unless you're surrounded by very dull bananas. Alright, so before we go, Danny, this is the time when we like to give the mic over to our guest to plug anything that you might want to plug. Do you have anything you'd like to plug?
No.
If people wanted to find you on the internet, assuming you'd like to be found, where might they find you?
I think they should just enjoy their lives and enjoy this time that we got to spend together. And they shouldn't have to worry about where I might be. And if we run into each other, it's because it was meant to be. And if we don't, you know, we had tonight.
God bless.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
We should all have such positive and detached relationships to the miasma of social media.
Yep.
Well, thanks for listening to this episode of Muppeturgy. Join us in two weeks from now in a galaxy far, far away for a discussion of the Star Wars episode. You can find us on social media at Muppeturgy or on the web at Muppeturgy.com. You can buy our merch at Muppeturgy.com/store. Our theme music was composed and performed by Christy Bauer. Our show logo was created by Todd Ryan Backus. And this episode was edited by me, David Levin. I'm just going to say that we know that these trolls are fuckable because Liza Minnelli fucked one of them.